Richard Mabian is president of the Kansas City, Kansas chapter of the NAACP. He's also the first Black member of the Sierra Club in Kansas City, and he's recently started a new organization. It's called Building a Sustainable Earth Community, an environmental literacy organization reaching out specifically to people who haven't been included in the conversation about saving the planet, because it often comes across as something only privileged communities really have the time or resources to deal with. He's written about it in an essay titled Justice and Climate Action in Kansas City, Kansas. It's a beautiful, poetic essay. It's also quite disheartening. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Richard Mabian to kick off a discussion about how inequality in Kansas City might shape how different communities experience climate change, starting with how prepared we are for it. Call 816-235-2888 to join the discussion. Richard, hello.
Good morning.
It's hard to imagine an issue more global than climate change. Why do you feel motivated to address climate change within very specific communities in a particular corner of a particular city?
You know, in the climate change concern for the reduction in greenhouse gases, there's a list of potential areas that they consider to be priority. They have as many as 100 of them. But we all know, those of us that are in the industry, that in order for any of those priorities to be successful, it has to be inclusive of the total population. You can't have a successful greenhouse reduction program going on in the suburbs and the city is still without one. So that's why it became necessary to focus in that particular portion of the population to try to bring them up to spiff.
I referenced the essay you wrote, Justice and Climate Action in Kansas City, Kansas. In that essay, you share a quote that inspired you to get into this intersection of social justice and climate change. This is the quote: "Leadership to create a world that works for all is more likely to come from those who live in the real world and consequently are intimately acquainted with the injustice, violence, and environmental failure that the empire, capital E, has wrought."
Yes.
How and why did that quote speak to you?
First of all, before I had read that quote, I had no clue or any intentions of being part of this environmental world. But because of my civil rights background, I knew that if someone did not get into this industry and learn it from the inside out and be able to come back and share with people what it was they needed to do to be able to produce, when it came time for that leadership that quote was talking about to take its place, as it is now, the low income, in fact, I said the Black portion of the population could very easily be without that kind of leadership, which would put us in the same circumstance we are right now as far as economic development is concerned. So that was my reason for being motivated to get involved in the environmental world. And that's why that statement was so profound.
You wrote that essay as part of a course you just completed at Cornell University, a course on climate action planning, and you came out of that with a commitment to something you call inner city climate change consciousness.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, I don't think you will find people sitting around the dinner tables in the inner city. In fact, I'm glad you said that, because I just came up with a list of what I had to speak to a student at KU about, because he was asking the same question about people being concerned in the inner city. And I said, if I had to ask the people that I work with, I serve, what were their top five concerns in the inner city, they would come up with: one, the lack of job training; two, the lack of employment opportunities; three, outrageous monthly utility bills. People over in the low-income community in Kansas City, Kansas, are paying in excess of $550 a month for utility bills. Their fourth one would be violence. And their fifth one would be a lack of real representation in the public school system. None of them would say a word about the environment.
For totally understandable reasons, I would add.
Correct.
Why should that be different than it is?
Well, I'm not saying that there would be anything different, but I think we need to be able, when we approach them, instead of going there with programs to teach you how to conserve energy, we should be going in with programs that teaches you about energy. I see the job creation portion of it, or the job training portion of it, as being a key area for us to be zeroing in with training that has to do with energy efficiency. Now we're killing two birds with one stone. Now we got people that are learning marketable skills in an area that's also teaching them about the energy crisis that we have going on in this country. That person,
you're talking to people about the problems that they need to solve for themselves, well, in addition to...
Right. Well, we're not so much talking as we actually teaching them how to correct those problems. If it has to do with constructions, you're building energy, using energy-efficient materials and products to create these... To shore up a home, put caulking windows or the kind of stuff you need to do. And the reason you're doing it, you're teaching them it's about energy efficiency. Then they become the ones that go home. When they're sitting at the dinner table, they're talking or drinking coffee. They're talking about, you know, I didn't know you could put plastic on your windows, man, and cut your utility bills. I mean, this is, I'm learning so much. Now that consciousness becomes a factor within the home, and that's where it needs to be. It's okay to try to take it there from outside the home, but we run into too many barriers. Trust, well, why are you doing it? What's your motivation? But when it comes from that kitchen table, now it becomes a reality within the family itself.
Okay, but talk to me about those barriers you just described, starting with trust.
Ah, boy. Well, that's an American problem across the board that you have to deal with. There have been so many missteps since the advent of the civil rights movement, integration in this country, that both sides have turned into, just like the problems we're having in Washington, D.C., is the drawing the line in the sand. And you're on one side or another. And because of that, the kind of conversations that need to be going on are not going on. So consequently, the folks that are in positions to actually empower our various communities find themselves in the low-income community blaming the other side for all of their problems. It's not me anymore. It's about what they're doing that's keeping me from being able to do what I want to do. So that's why it's necessary to be able to get around those barriers and deal with this environmental issue, because that's a totally separate issue. I do believe, and also goes along with that original statement I got, that the environmental movement is the first movement we've had in this country since the civil rights movement that actually has a chance to change policy in this country. We need to be in a position to make sure we learn how it needs to be employed so we can actually do that.
And so that everyone is included in the solution.
Everyone has to be.
I want to bring in another guest on this, Tom Jacobs. He's with us from MARC, the Mid-America Regional Council. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning, Gina.
You like to say that climate change isn't going to create new problems of inequality. It's going to multiply existing inequalities. Explain that.
Well, as a community, we've dealt with issues like flooding, excessive heat, severe weather, tornadoes. These are things that we've lived with for a very long time. And I think what we're seeing about climate change is that it's in a sense a threat multiplier, so it can increase the severity or the intensity or the frequency or the duration of different kinds of events, and in a sense exacerbate impacts from trends that we've been familiar with for a long time. The key thing about the program today, of course, is that we know that these impacts are going to be disproportionately distributed in the community. And so those who are most vulnerable amongst us might bear the brunt of the burden. And so trying to figure out how we can work with Richard and communities from across the region is really, you know, the challenge in front of us.
Give me a picture of a scenario here in Kansas City that fits within projections for climate change, where some Kansas Cityans are likely to experience the fallout more acutely than others.
So there's a variety of scenarios. I think when people talk about climate change, oftentimes they think about the Katrinas or the Harveys or the huge fires in California. And those events are very real, and trying to think about disaster preparedness and resilience from those is really important. I think in a lot of ways, what we're talking here about more chronic things. And so we did it, what we call a downscaled climate model for Kansas City a couple of years ago. And one of the findings was is that by the year 2100, we might have about 22 days per year over 105 degrees Fahrenheit as compared to 0.7 days per year now. So if it gets that much hotter, then it brings with it all kinds of different potential impacts. One of those might be doubling the demand for air conditioning, because it's just hotter in the summertime, right? If you don't have access to air conditioning, or you can't afford to pay your energy bill because utility bills are higher, then you've got incredible public health risks. And so the opportunity then to, you know, take measures to, just like Richard was saying, to make your house more energy efficient, to help drop the bills and increase comfort and your own personal safety and health is really important. So when I step back from an issue like that, if it gets that hot, I'm a privileged white male, right? If it gets that hot, I can turn up my air conditioner and I'm going to be able to afford to pay the bill, even if it hurts a little bit. But what happens if I live in a place where I can't afford to pay the bill, or I don't even have an air conditioner? Now you've got absolute public health risks, because there's all kinds of communities that are in that exact situation, and it brings with it all kinds of different problems. At the same time, one of the public health risks associated with climate change might be an increase in allergens or air quality issues. And so these are things that we've lived with for a long time. When it's hotter, ozone formation might accelerate. There might be more allergens. There might be more pollen. So now we're talking about issues of access to health care, which traces back to issues of inequality that Richard was describing. And so these issues can sort of cascade, and the way we all are prepared to deal with them is incredibly variable around the community.
Yeah, I was even thinking about the ability to move from one part of the city to another, that the privilege of having that option, if what is an ideal neighborhood to live in now under these climate circumstances becomes not that due to proximity to flooding, or due to, you know, the charming old house may not be so charming anymore for the reasons you've described, like that access to choice.
Absolutely. So in a lot of ways, our community has been working on a wide range of sustainability issues for a long time, including related to transportation. So we're asking ourselves, how can we build more walkable communities? How can we facilitate more transit-oriented development? How can we create different kinds of ways for people to move around the community in ways that are agile, that are nimble, that are functional? And all of those measures are important for a lot of reasons. They're important in the face of climate change, but they're important for lots of other reasons as well, for people to able to get to work, for people to live healthy, active lifestyles, and other kinds of things.
Do you have other scenarios that might help our listeners really think along these lines? Maybe breaking it down in terms of hourly wage workers versus salaried folks.
One thing that was really striking to me is, do you remember a few years ago when there was that massive snowstorm up in Boston?
Yeah, I also remember this past winter, though, when there was one here.
Right. Well, I remember I was up in Boston about a week after that storm. I think they got about 100 inches plus of snow. And folks who were who had jobs that when they were paid on an hourly basis weren't able to get to work for about 4 or 5 days. And so imagine the consequences in your household if you just can't pay your bills because you couldn't get to work. I don't know if the problem was that severe here in Kansas City last winter, but it creates disruptions, right? And it makes it harder for folks to get to work and to do the kind of things that they need to do. And so trying to have mobility systems, transportation systems that anticipate that and accommodate that in ways that work is really important.
Richard, maybe, and when Tom says that this isn't about creating new inequalities, it's a question of multiplying existing ones. I am curious, do you see these inequalities playing out during Kansas City weather events already?
Wow, that's a good question. We could go back to the snowstorm we had last year, and of course, it is having an effect. But now there's one thing I want to point out, and I think it has to do with why David Corton, that guy that had that made that statement, said that that the people who have suffered the most injustices would be where that leadership would come from. It has to do with the order of survival. The kind of circumstances that are multiplying themselves that the population is having to deal with are the kind that they have not had to figure out how to survive in it. When you come to the low-income community, that is their number one way of living life. They have been learning to survive. Every day they have to learn how to survive. So it's just another survival necessity. And so they, it doesn't have that effect on them yet. But as Tom was saying, if we go multiply as far as how many days of heat we have, then very easily that could happen.
We're talking about how inequality plays into climate change projections for Kansas City on KCUR's Central Standard. Call 816-235-2888 if your experience of weather events, extreme temperatures, is already being affected by the size of your bank account, the neighborhood you live in, or any other life experience. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're hearing from Tom Jacobs of the Mid-America Regional Council and Richard Mabian, president of the NAACP in Kansas City, Kansas, who's recently founded an organization called Building a Sustainable Earth Community. We're talking about inequality and climate change in Kansas City. Welcome back, you two.
Thank you.
So you are welcome to join this conversation at 816-235-2888 right now. I do have few more questions about the specific impacts of inequality. Can I name just a few issues that we have in Kansas City and get your take on how they intersect with everything we've been discussing? I want to start with flooding. We already have flooding. Climate change anticipates more flooding.
It's true. Our climate projections show that it will be at times much wetter, at times much drier. It'll be hotter. So we can expect to see greater incidence of flooding. I'm working on a project with the engineering faculty at Kansas State University, and one of their suggestions as they look at the climate models and try and anticipate what might be coming our way is that everything might shift over one confidence interval. So that means that the 2-year storm becomes the 1-year storm, the 5-year storm becomes the 2-year storm, the 200-year storm becomes the 100-year storm. So these are probabilities, right? A 100-year storm would presumably have a 1% chance of occurring. So what that means is we're going to see a greater frequency of larger events. But one of the things that's really interesting is that we believe that not the amount of rain we get in one rainfall is important, but we might expect to see storms stack on each other more, just as we saw kind of in northern Missouri and Nebraska this past year. So when the ground becomes super saturated and then it rains some more, and it rains a lot more, then it creates increased risks and vulnerabilities in the community. And so this question of flooding is really important. A couple of years ago, we had a couple of very substantial events on Indian Creek. It was broadly discussed around the community. I think it's the kind of thing that we need to anticipate and prepare for as we're building and managing our cities to be able to minimize those risks.
Do we anticipate those risks having an impact that varies from one community to another in relation to inequality?
I haven't actually done a detailed analysis on this, but I might suggest that let's say you look at Town Fork Creek neighborhood in Kansas City, Missouri. It's tributary to Brush Creek east of the plaza, a couple of miles. A very substantial portion of that community is located within the floodplain and experiences repeated flooding. I know the city's working really hard to try and figure out how to deal with that in the context of all the water management issues in that community. But it really is an issue at the intersection of social equity, community revitalization, climate change, and it's really thorny.
Richard, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, and I think it's good that I have chosen to work in the portion of the population that I'm working in, the part of the cities that I'm working, because those things that Tom just talked about are never a part of a conversation that I have with anybody in those kinds of in the areas that I'm located. the comments he just made about the studies that they're doing about the problems with the water, like going through the plaza and that whole area. And it makes you wonder how much of that is being discussed in those low-income communities. I the only place that I know that would be an ideal location to research and find out is the ones that's past the plaza that goes on over through the neighborhood, the Turkey Creek, is that what it is?
Yeah, Turkey Creek.
That goes on over where when they had the flooding that went into the black community, you know, and ended up in the trees and all that. I wonder how those people feel now after experiencing that, because from time to time you hear of people driving through it, and, you know, I don't see it as being something that you are weary of, or when it starts raining and saying, oh, we better get ready. And I think in those terms because of the work that I do. But how many people actually think in those terms that when that rain starts occurring that, oh, we better get ready because, you know, this is the way it comes when it floods? I just don't know. I haven't, and I'm saying I'm around people. The church that I attend is in Kansas City, Missouri, and a lot of those folks are actively involved in neighborhood stuff, and I've never heard any of them really talking about, you know, oh, man, it's getting ready to rain. I need to be concerned about it. So that would be, that's what I was thinking when he was talking, is how little I hear anyone really talking about those issues.
When it comes to something like food deserts, something that does get a lot of traction in public discourse right now as it relates to inequality on that neighborhood level, do you think that food access is something that we need to think about in environmental terms from a climate change projection standpoint?
Food deserts, that's what we're talking about,
yeah.
Right? That's what this note that I read from earlier was to this student. I consider the term food desert a white middle class word. I have heard no persons in the inner city except those who are trying to figure out how they can captivate on some money that may be floating through say a word about a food desert. And I have heard no one saying they having a problem getting food. I mean, even though it's not a grocery store within their walking space, people are not starving. I think when that order survival, they get to the store, they get their food, and they go back home. So when you ask me, we have to separate it from the majority and then the minority, and I'm saying the minority is not complaining about food. And church Sunday, a pastor set up and talked about the sandwich that just came back out at Popeyes. And everybody, I said that because they know I'm a vegetarian, so they all look at me crazy. But I'm sitting there looking at how enthusiastic everybody in the church was about getting a backup sandwich from Popeye's. So I'm saying that is not an issue. Employment is the issue in the inner city.
It's an interesting thing. But, Richard, would you think that everybody has access to fresh, healthy produce?
No, they don't. But they're aware of that. In fact, you know, that's why I'm doing the things that I'm doing, is trying to create these raised bed gardens with community garden folks to reinstill in their mind how it used to be that way. And so when I have some put into a public housing unit over in Kansas City, Kansas, the elderly people who live there are so excited. It brings them back to how life used to be. But does that cause them to sit at home or in around the room going, boy, I wish I had me a fresh piece of lettuce? No. So that means our younger generation is not hearing it either. And that's the problem. We need them to hear that.
It's interesting. I'm familiar with studies that show that maybe 250,000 people in our metro area out of a population of around 2 million are food insecure. And I think the definition of that might impact people's daily lives in all kinds of different ways, depending on their situations. But if that's true,
it sounds like the conversation about it varies from one community to the next,
yeah,
too, and the terminology that's being used and everything.
Absolutely. But I have noticed over the last number of years that there's just been an explosion of activity of people building community gardens,
yes,
and planting community orchards. And it's absolutely to the benefit of the folks who do it in any part of town,
right,
where folks are involved. One of the things I find really interesting at the intersection of climate and agriculture is, as a region, we might throw away about 400,000 tons of food waste in landfills every year,
That's right.
which is just a staggering number. Some of that food could be captured and used to feed people, literally. For those parts that can't be, we could compost it. So then we have absolutely enormous amounts of quantities of compost that we could use to improve our soils and sequester carbon, while at the same time we're growing healthy food and restoring our landscapes.
So this is very encouraging in the sense that here the intersection is of an intersection of solutions.
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and if you noticed, the conversation went to the community gardens of people doing that over building a grocery store that they run into a grocery store. They're starting to see that as a way of life. And some people, I think, in the one story that I have where this one group put in a community garden, and the neighbors just come and eat it. They're not like picking it, put a food market, a stand down the street. They just leave it open to the neighbors, and they're starting to come out, and now they're helping them work the garden and the whole bit. So in a way, that's starting to manifest itself in what we're doing out here in the communities.
So mental health. We've heard studies about mental health crises being triggered by excessive heat. It's also been widely reported that mental health care resources have been dwindling. Do you think of this intersection as a place where climate change and equal access to resources might become problematic?
I might. A few years ago, there was a study published by Michael Bloomberg, Henry Paulson, and Tom Steyer called The Risky Business Project. And in that study, they suggested that there could be a 5.3% increase in violent crime solely due to hotter temperatures, mm-hmm. which is sort of a reflection of what you're talking about. It can create psychological stress, and that stress could manifest in all kinds of different ways in a personal level or at a community level. And so the need to have resources to deal with that and to be able to take very active measures to address the problem of heat at a psychological level, at a community planning level, at an emergency response kind of level, are all really critical.
Yeah, and when it comes to mental health, that's an issue with me because when you have stress in your home because of employment circumstances or bills needing to be paid, that creates a momentary kind of mental health that shows up in domestic violence. It shows up in the abuse of children. It shows up in children abusing, bullying other children. It kind of has that ripple effect, you know. You kick the dog and it just keeps going on down the line. So what I've had to learn to do is we have to separate the portions that we're working with in different degrees. So if we can separate those people who have that momentary mental health issue based on life circumstances from those who really are in situations that have that kind of mental health issue as far as violence and things are concerned, we can start eliminating the amount of people we need to work with.
Richard Mabian, thank you so much. Richard is giving a talk at Donnelly College this Friday. Tomorrow, it's called Environmental Justice, What Can We Do? We'll link to it with the audio from this discussion at kcur.org/Central Standards. Tom Jacobs with us from the Mid-America Regional Council. Thank you.
Thank you back.
Thank you.
Up next, the story on the KU student pictured on national television knitting alone at a college football game and a retiree from Japan determined to grow rice in Kansas. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And here's something you don't typically hear on ESPN sports coverage.
We'll see how far along this lady is with her knitting in about 25 minutes. If she can get something warmer for Tom down on the field.
I don't know who Tom is. I'm sorry, everyone. If you followed the crochet lady story, you know what he's talking about, though. A KU student's picture went viral when ESPN showed her crocheting alone at a KU home football game. And alone is putting it mildly. The camera slowly pans out to show more and more empty seats around her. So not the vision of sports mayhem viewers probably expected from a Jayhawks game. Well, today, we will get Crochet Lady's side of that story. Haley Solomon, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So the hot take on this from ESPN was that you sitting there quietly crocheting in the stands captured the level of excitement at this football game. Is that your take?
Oh, I wouldn't say so at all. Actually, if the camera would have panned out a little bit more, you would have seen the entire student section right near me, and they were going wild.
So, why were you at the game? Let's start there.
So, I nominated one of the most amazing and influential people in my life, Dr. Matt O'Reilly, for the 2019 HOPE Award, which is the honor for the Outstanding Progressive Educator. And I learned that he would be receiving the award at that football game, so I decided to attend. But being very unskilled in the knowledge of football and whatnot, I just brought my crocheting because the only purpose I had there was to watch him and support him.
And you very deliberately chose a spot where you could be alone, right?
Yes, I did. I actually get overstimulated at sporting events, so I elected to sit in an emptier area up in the student section just so I could support my professor and have a better view of him.
So what ESPN sees as a statement about KU football, I personally see as an act of bravery for an introvert going to this event that is absolutely made for people who love noise and crowds and group fanaticism, sitting there with your needles crocheting blankets in the quietest spot you could find.
Well, I'm glad you saw it that way. It was certainly a wonderful experience.
Did it feel that way to you?
I wouldn't call it an act of bravery. I was truly just there to support my amazing professor, and I mean, I understand that football games are fun for a lot of people, and so it was nice to just be in an area where everybody seemed to be enjoying themselves, and I did too, just not in the way you would expect.
Speaking of peace or solitude, I understand you plan to join a convent after graduation. You want to become a nun.
Yes, that is true.
Tell me about that.
Well, when I first entered KU, I planned to be a missionary, and that's why I got into civil engineering. I felt it would be really beneficial in the missionary field. As I grew, though, I gained independence and confidence, and I just kind of understood myself a little better. And as time progressed, I felt a call to the sisterhood, and I've been pursuing it ever since.
And what you were knitting for folks who might be cold this winter.
I was actually crocheting a pot holder for my lab coordinator, Woody, who is one of the most amazing people I've ever met. But I have founded an organization called Warm the World that makes warm clothes for the homeless.
Haley Solomon, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Haley is the KU senior, better known as Crochet Lady, thanks to her recent 15 Seconds of Fame on ESPN. And now, before we go, tomorrow is a food show on Central Standard. We'll be talking about rice and its importance to cuisines and cultures all over the world. That show was inspired in part by the story of a Japanese immigrant in Kansas who's been growing rice on rice paddies in wheat country. He is out of town, but his wife is his business partner, and she is here with us now to tell their story. Susan Nakao, Kansas rice farmer, good morning.
Good morning.
They said it was impossible to grow rice in Kansas, but your husband, Koji Nakao, really wanted this. He dreamed his whole life of being able to own land and grow rice. Why is that?
Well, that's very true. And I was one of the people who said it's impossible because I grew up in Kansas as a cowgirl. But anyway, my husband was 18 months old living in Hiroshima Prefecture when we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. And, of course, at 18 months, he didn't remember hardly anything of it. When we married 33 years ago, I was a professor and a little bit of a feminist, and I said, I suppose I have to cook for you 3 meals a day now, so is there anything you don't want to eat? And he said, I don't eat sweet potatoes. Please never serve sweet potatoes. Being a Kansas girl, I thought, oh, sweet potatoes are so good. A little bit of marshmallow is great. Then he told me the story that after the devastation of the atomic bomb and the fire bombings that happened before the atomic bomb, he and his family, he had four total siblings, and he was the youngest, and they did not have enough money to own land or buy rice. But the government wanted to take care of people in that situation, so they told them they could grow sweet potatoes in barrels. So he told me that for every meal until he was 12 years old, he had sweet potatoes. So that's the backstory.
Yeah, and that landowners did have access to rice.
Oh, yes. They could grow their own rice. So when we purchased a 40-acre farm in Kansas, one of the first things he said to me was, I want to grow rice. And I said, we can't grow rice in Kansas. We don't have running water. And he said, I think we can grow rice.
Okay, so take me back a little bit to your background. You mentioned that you're, as you put it, a Kansas cowgirl.
High school rodeo. My grandfather had a farm, raised cows, and I did haying with him every summer. And I thought I knew a lot about farming. I know nothing. There's like 1,000 questions a day. But we do at this time do something we call yoco gardening or yoco farming. We have about a 2-acre vegetable and fruit area. The rice makes up another 1/5 of an acre. And then we have a small orchard also.
Talk to me about the first conversations between you and your husband now that we've heard more about your two different backgrounds with agriculture. These first conversations about growing rice in Kansas in a county where no one has produced rice before.
Japanese people don't talk very much. So in fact, shortly after we married, one of the first things he said to me was, now we need to communicate without talking. And I said, what? I like to talk. So Japanese people don't talk very much. So I'm not sure that we had extended conversations, but in my mind, I thought, this has been a wonderful man. He's a wonderful husband. He's provided for myself and my daughter, our daughter, for all of these years. And he's really never asked for anything except that he wants to grow rice. I could be married to a man that in his senior years wants a $40,000 pickup. So if he thinks he can grow rice, we're going to figure out how to do it. So we had a discussion. We don't have running water on the property, but we do have a well. Well, we do have running water, but it's down in a woods.
Can you explain why that's problematic for rice in particular?
Rice requires water. If you're growing rice in Japan, they're usually right next to a mountain stream. You build up a little dam. You let the water in on your field. You take it off of your field. At certain times, you put it back on. It has to do with training the rice to put roots down more deeply. But we didn't have that running water in a sunny area. So we ended up building, I called a pond builder. And he came out and he put in three 30-foot by 40-foot, so 1,200 square-foot ponds. They were slightly terraced. My husband said, we'll use the upper one to heat well water. In the meantime, the pond builder said, break that terrace in that pasture up there and you'll get water into it, which we did. And we really haven't put very much well water in it. So we put valves in between the three patties, and so the water can run from the upper reservoir down into the second and the third patties where the rice is grown. And that's good because well water is very cold and rice likes 50 degrees or more.
Do you remember your first rice harvest?
That would have been just about 3 years ago. And it was amazing. I was just like, he really did it. Now, I had been growing. We had gotten some very special rice from Japan. It's, let's see if I can remember, Koshi Hikari is the brand and one of the favorite short grain rices from Japan. And I had gotten a handful of seeds from a sacred temple there and had been growing them in a very small fish pond, 4 feet by 6 feet, for several years just to keep the seeds going. So those are the ones we planted that first year. And I just couldn't believe how well it grew. We actually had a drought the first year, and we only had to fill the paddy with well water one time. So it was amazing. He basically is the one who plants, and he basically is the one who harvests, and I watch. I help a little bit from the bank, but I'm not going in the muddy paddy.
So it Describe what a rice paddy is like, because as you have noted, most of us around here do not have firsthand experience of rice paddies.
Right. So ours are very small. And right now, we've harvested and we just finished threshing right before he went to Japan a week ago. And the rice paddy is dry right now and it has stubble where it's cut. However, in the spring, early spring, he'll dig up that stubble, which hasn't already composted, and we are making compost all the time for our vegetables and rice. And so he'll put compost in and he'll till it, and it'll all be dry at that point. At the same time, he'll be starting seedlings in our little greenhouse. The seedlings will grow for maybe about 3 weeks, and then he'll flood the paddy. And then he goes out and he puts in a very small, maybe 1-inch clump of rice, and it's probably about 5 or 6 inches tall, and you put it in every 10 to 12 inches. He's decided 10 inches is perfect. So he puts in the rice, you put it in nice straight rows, and you let it start to grow for a little while. When it starts to get several more leaves, he actually drains the paddy so that it makes the rice send roots down more deeply to get more nutrition. He leaves the paddy drained for about a week, and in our case, we re-pump the water back to the upper reservoir. So he leaves it drained for about a week, and then he floods it again. It stays flooded then until it starts to grow grain. So this planting is taking place probably the last week of May or the first week of June. The draining takes place probably the end of June for about a week. Then you fill it back up. And late September, early October, you have full-fledged rice grains and you drain all the water off so it becomes dry before you harvest.
Getting back to this very first rice harvest in Kansas, the event that you believe to be impossible, we've talked about that. You said it was amazing. You said it was amazing, and that's your take, and it sounds that way to me, too. How did your husband feel about it? I know you've said he does not talk a lot. Did he talk about it then? Did he express?
He was excited, and he was confident, and he kind of knew he could do it. Our whole marriage is kind of that way. He says, I'll do this, and I'll say it can't be done, and he does it, you know, so that's kind of good. But anyway, he was very happy. The thing that was unusual, we dry the rice for about 2 weeks after it's been harvested. You harvest it in a big clump, whatever you can hold in your hand, and he uses a hand sickle to harvest it. And then you're supposed to tie it with another piece of rice, but I'm the one who does the tying, and I couldn't figure out how to do it with rice, so I used natural jute that would rot. So I'm tying each clump, and then you're supposed to hang it to dry. Well, I had this wonderful idea that we could put a drying rack up with tubifores, and it would be temporary. So I built this wonderful temporary tubifore drying rack, and that first season, in the 2 weeks it took to dry the rice, it blew over 3 times. And had to be set up, and all the rice hung again at about 3 hours labor each time. So before the next season, 2 years ago, we put in a permanent drying rack. We set 4x4 posts and ran metal pipe in between them. And that's where we dried it last year and this year.
So you've been doing this for 3 years, the harvesting mm-hmm. piece of it. You've gotten to that stage for 3 years. Mm-hmm. What do you do with the rice?
It's a very long process. Once we get it threshed, so once it's dried, he brought a threshing machine home on a plane from Japan. He had thought he could do it a petal thresher. He's a little bit older and decided that was too much work, and we found a very creative electrician who added a motor to it. Too loud, but you put on headphones and it's fine. Or ear protectors and it's fine. So once it's, then you run it through the thresher. That takes him, he produces between 250 and 300 pounds of grain each year. This year was a little less. We had some real, we were just talking about climate change. We had a little bit of issues with all the rain this year and trying to get the rice in the ground. Everybody thinks, oh, rain is good for the rice. Well, at certain times. So it was a little less of a harvest this year, probably still close to 250 pounds. Once it's threshed, unlike wheat, which I grew up with, the husk comes off very easily on the wheat, but the rice, the husk is much more, it's stronger. It takes more effort to get it off. So you leave the husk on it and you can store it for up to a year. So we put it in large metal cans with lids to keep the mice and rats out, store it in our barn. And once every month, we take out about 12 pounds of it and we run it through a very small husker. And then we polish it from all rice is brown rice till you take the bran off. That's the polishing process. So we run it through a small polisher. 12 pounds takes me maybe an hour to polish. And then we run it through a winnower as the last step. The husker's actually supposed to separate all the husks out, but it doesn't quite make it so.
But who eats the rice?
So at this point, my husband is a teacher in a spiritual practice from Japan. It's called Sukyo Mahikari, means Sukyo is universal principles and Mahikari is the true light. And our headquarters for the North American region, Sukyo Mahikari is in 110 countries throughout the world with a million practitioners. But the North American region, which has about 27 centers, one of which is on our property at our home, once a month they have a Thanksgiving ceremony and they offer the blessings of heaven and earth, the blessings from the mountains, the oceans, the plains, and the fields. And they had never been able to offer organically grown, we call yoko rice, from the United States or Canada. So we send 12 pounds a month to them for their Thanksgiving ceremony. And then after the ceremony, it's distributed to the people who participated in the ceremony, and they're encouraged to give it to people who are either in need of food or people who are having health issues or something like that. We eat only a very small amount of the rice we grow.
What is your favorite? If you eat a small amount of it yourselves, that must be special to you.
It's pretty special. I'm not a huge rice fan.
Are you kidding me?
No. My first 5 years of marriage, I was 35 when we married, and I thought, oh, I should try to be a Japanese wife because Kansas cowgirls need all the refinement they can get. And I made rice and miso every morning for his breakfast with pickled vegetables, just the way he would get it in Japan from a Japanese rice. And I sat down and ate it with him. And somewhere in the fifth year, I sat down and broke out into tears. And he said, what's the matter? And I said, I want cereal. I don't want rice. He said, I don't care what you eat. Just make sure I get rice. So after that, I haven't eaten a lot of rice. But he will take... every month when we prepare the 12 pounds, he will maybe have a half pound more, and he will take just a handful of that rice and put it into the organic rice, which we purchase from the store. And he says it totally changes. And I'll eat rice once in a while, but I'm not an everyday rice eater.
Do you know of what is his favorite rice dish to eat at home?
Oh, because of tomorrow's program.
Yes.
Yeah, his favorite rice dish. Jeez. He loves it every way, but probably sushi is one of the favorite. Chirashi sushi he loves. And people, sushi actually has to do with the vinegar and the sugar on the rice, but that's probably his favorite.
When you talk about your two stories and how they've become intertwined, and how rice is kind of an expression of that in a lot of ways, growing rice in Kansas. How did the two of you meet to begin with?
Mm-hmm.
I have to know.
Yeah. Well, it's from the Sukyo Mahikari. I was actually, it's hard for me to say this because I have three generations who graduated from KU, but I went to MU at Columbia to get my PhD. And I went off to Northern Kentucky University to start teaching there and was assigned a full professor in ceramics department who had just become a member of Sukyo Mahikari. And he gave me true light, and I could feel the energy, but clear back then in the 70s had no explanation. So I ended up meeting my husband at a staff training for Sukyo Mahikari people about 3 years after that.
Susan Nakao, Kansas rice farmer, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Please come see our rice patties.
I would love to. That is a wrap for today's show, but we'll hear about lots of rice dishes on Kansas City menus, drawing inspiration from around the globe on tomorrow's show with the food critics. So tune in for that. Everything we talked about today will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard later on. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Not only the story of the Nakao family and their rice, but also Crochet Lady at KU and the crossover between social justice issues and environmental ones. We're on our way out, but talk to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.